When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Welcome to part two of our interview with the grandson of Ed and Lorraine Warren, Christopher Edward McKinnell, and about his experiences growing up in the family and his experiences as a paranormal investigator himself, Annabelle, and obviously another very famous case that they were involved with. What was your knowledge of that as a child, and how did your learning of that begin?
Well, Annabelle didn't show up until I was almost 10 years old.
Okay.
So I didn't have to deal with her.
Sure.
She was always in the box, mm-hmm. On display, never had to deal with her. It was spooky as heck. Definitely creepy. Mm-hmm. And for your listeners who don't know, Annabelle is a Raggedy Ann doll.
Yeah.
So, most of those are really cute.
Sure.
But not the real Annabelle, no. But I've never had to deal with Annabelle. Annabelle has always been contained. She's shown up at a couple of psychics that I work with, projecting herself. Mm-hmm. But she really can't do anything. Not anymore.
Why is it? Why is it that she can't do anything anymore?
It's the way she's sealed in with prayers, with blessed salt. We've got her locked down.
Okay. Have you ever had...
Well, that's the whole purpose of the museum, to be quite honest.
Sure. I mean, and that's such an interesting thing to me with that museum, with all of those objects that are there that obviously are connected to so many different, dark cases, dark spirits, demons, whatever you want to call it. I guess my question there is how is it all contained when it's all of those things are all together in one space? What is done to keep that in there? And has anything ever, found its way out the door?
Nothing's ever gotten out the door.
Okay.
No. We've had incidents inside the building. Lights going on and off and
sure.
Things moving. But it's really rare.
Okay.
It's like after my grandfather died, the lights would go on and off every once in a while. But I think that was probably my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Letting us know that he was around.
Okay.
One of the things about my family, we have an unusual relationship with death. We tend to come back and visit, so it's hard to get too worked up about it. Each and every one of those items is dealt with. Excuse me. On its own when it arrives. We use different prayers. We make sure that it's surrounded with salt. We make sure that nobody ever touches them. We don't want to create any new attachments. Mm-hmm. And so they remain in a static, a kind of a limbo, where they're not able to hurt anybody. We're not releasing those entities back out. They're anchored to the items that they're attached to.
Okay. Almost, you could almost...
Which is exactly why we do this.
Sure.
I mean, we could destroy them, but then those entities get loose.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is there a way to take the entity out of the object? But that would do exactly that. It would just release it to go to someone or something else.
Exactly. That's why we don't do that.
It's almost like you have a real life Ghostbuster containment unit there.
Yeah.
and the objects are essentially the ghost traps. I mean, to put it in as layman of a term as you could, that really is kind of what it's like.
I do want to warn people, though.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember the fellow's name. There's this show that everybody likes, Ghost Adventures, I think.
Sure.
And he's got this giant museum in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
He sells his items. I've had cases where somebody bought a human skull and they had trouble afterward. You know, to me, that's the height of irresponsibility.
Yeah.
You know, don't start having collections of haunted items. We don't do this for publicity or anything. We're there trying to protect you from these items.
Yeah.
So I just want to caution people. I'm a huge proponent of stay away from the supernatural.
Sure. It's an interesting thing because you do see that today where people are literally trying to sell haunted items. I've seen things.
And most of that is garbage.
Sure. I mean, exactly. It's someone going, oh, people will believe this and I can make a buck. You know, it's dishonest, but even if it was honest, it's still messed up. One of the interesting things I've seen now, too, is people taking pieces of haunted buildings and then trying to sell them. I've seen that with the Amityville house. I've seen, you know, where somebody took a piece of the, you know, railing or whatever. And you got to think, well, you know, when this occurred, it's probably been remodeled a little bit. It's probably not the same wood from back then, technically, you know, but
probably not the same building. They moved it.
So, yeah, I mean, there's so many things that are probably not exactly quite, you know, what you think it is. But people are trying to, you know. There's a thing, and until I think people are physically affected and mentally affected by it, it is fun and games in their mind until they call you.
whether it be playing with matches or guns or cigarettes or anything else, people are destructive.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the more you warn them of the dangers, often the more they want to try it.
When you started to tell me the journey that you took then in how you got into what you're doing now with the Warren Legacy Foundation and how you transitioned into doing your own investigations and such. What was that like?
Oh, that was almost immediate.
Okay.
Yeah, my grandfather, by the time I was 20, he had me going on cases on my own. I was often lead researcher. I had a partner I worked with I was in college still. Mm-hmm. I was doing lectures, I was teaching, I was going into places like Maurice Thurial in Warren, Massachusetts. He's the farmer that came under possession. I was up in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. I was in West Pittston, Pennsylvania. What's that book called? The Haunted?
Yes.
Of course, the Haunting in Connecticut, that was actually my case. I was the lead researcher on that case.
Okay.
So it was just immediate. My grandfather just felt probably, well, I was in World War II when I was 16. This kid can do this stuff.
Sure.
So there wasn't a lot of thought that went into it. Just, hey, Chris, we got a case. You want to go? Yeah.
How interesting. When you went in and began investigating some of these things, obviously right off the bat from what you told me earlier, you went in and basically saw, you know, the fireworks show right away. As far as how extreme things could be. It wasn't like, hey, have a sparkler. It's going to be fun. You'll eventually, you know, work your way up. It was, here's everything. So going into these cases, these new experiences in these cases, what are some of the things that surprised you? I'd imagine the bar had been set pretty high at that point for getting scared, even.
Yeah. I used to get excited. Now I get mildly annoyed.
Okay.
I was in this house in West Tewksbury, Massachusetts. And I was there with my cousin. I had worked this house. It was a poltergeist case. And we were there 2 years later to introduce my cousin and to see how the family was doing. Nothing had happened. They invited us to spend the night, and one of the boys gave up his bed, and we were using it. We're both in our sleeping bags. The boy was about 15 feet away, sleeping on the floor in his bag. And my cousin starts complaining that I'm kicking the bed. And I'm like, John, look at me. I'm in my sleeping bag. I'm not kicking anything. Go back to sleep. A minute later, he's yelling at me again that I'm kicking the bed. And he turns on the light. The bed lifts up off the ground, flies across the room 10 feet, slams down, and breaks into pieces. That one shocked me. I laughed my butt off. I thought, now that took energy. And that, you know, another night, I was in a case in Newtown, Connecticut, and we could hear this woman, she was pregnant, screaming from the bedroom. And I had to push my cousin, who I was training at the time, I had to push him out of my way because he's screaming at me. And I'm like, just get out of the way. And I ran in, and the husband is levitating over the woman in a position like he's going to attack her. And I had to jump and tackle him in midair. Mm-hmm. So those are things that stuck with me. You know, but often the things that happen, you'll go, you're getting ready to go on a case, and the car won't start. You just finished up doing a house cleansing and breaking a generational curse, and you get rear-ended by another vehicle. All happen on the same day, as a matter of fact, both of those things. Or you start working with a woman who's being attacked, and three nights in a row, the gas turns on in your on your stove without the light going on, you know, without fire. Something's trying to scare you off. Happens all the time.
Do you ever pause on any of these cases where things like this, the gas turning on, I mean, the getting rear-ended, these are things that could potentially be life-threatening if whatever is doing these things succeeds, if you don't happen to catch it before its goal is met. Have you ever had a situation where you said, okay, this one, I keep getting lucky here. I'm catching these things that are trying to get me, but I don't know if my luck is going to run out at some point and I'm going to miss something or something's just going to get me.
No, it's not about me.
No?
I have faith.
Okay.
I'm not saving myself.
Okay.
And just because something's trying to hurt me doesn't mean it can hurt me.
Okay.
Sure, I've been in car accidents. Sure, I've been hurt.
Sure.
Per se. But they can only go so far. I live in chronic pain. I'm used to pain.
Okay.
I'm going to be fine with that for the rest of my life. God's got me. I don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
You know, and that's something else. This isn't... I'm not doing anything when I go on a case. Mm-hmm. You know, this is all about God.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I want to talk about another case that we've talked about on this program several times. I've had Andrea Perrin on a couple times.
I thought you were going to. And I honestly, I don't know a thing about the case other than what I've seen in the movie.
Okay. Okay. I wanted to touch on some of those things that that had been, you know, obviously in our what would be most likely known to our audience about some of the things.
I can tell you my grandmother loved the movie. She felt that it was very, very true.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think my grandfather ever did an exorcism.
No.
As for Amityville. As for Conjuring 2, that's a load of bull.
Yeah.
You know, they did a great job with what happened in the Enfield case, that didn't have anything to do with my grandparents.
Okay.
But the bits with my grandparents, the trying to connect it to Amityville, the whole haunted nun thing, all of that was James Wan.
Okay.
Who is a brilliant director and writer, but he's not a historian.
Sure. What I thought interesting about The Conjuring was, after talking with Andrea, just how normally, or what we see quite often, is a horror movie is made based on true story, and then people involved with the true story say, no, not so much. But I was very intrigued by Conjuring because Andrea immediately said, yeah, that's pretty darn accurate. And obviously even some of the things that your grandma had said in the interviews of how accurate it was. So I don't believe I've even actually seen all of Conjuring 2 because my wife refuses to watch it with me. but that's interesting to know that one kind of falls off the rails a little bit in terms of being super accurate to reality.
Oh, completely. Okay. Yeah. For instance, and spoiler alert, there's a point where my grandmother shouts out the name of the demon as if that's actually going to expel a demon.
Okay.
Yeah. Contrary to what people who call themselves demonologists believe, demons didn't get their names by themselves. We named them. And often they're names of old gods that the Catholic Church usurped and turned into demonic entities. Yeah, they're not in and of themselves. They're meaningless. The number of times I've gone up against a spirit who calls itself Legion or Beelzebub is ridiculous. And you know you're not seeing the same demon again and again and again. There are far too many of them for that. Plus, I've lived on 4 continents, 9 countries, and I've studied the hauntings everywhere. And they're all different, shaped by different cultures and different belief systems. So the names that we give them really are truly meaningless. And they're not necessary in any exorcism. What matters is what you believe is necessary. Your intent, your clear intent, your ritual to help shape that intent, the prayers you use, all of that is only shaping your faith into what you want to get out of it.
When someone is trying to expel something, when we talk about an exorcism or something of that nature, and we talk about how they're trying to get the entity to leave, is that something that is exclusive to one religion that is able to remove it? Okay. I'm curious about that, because obviously, you know, you have a lot where basically the Catholic or Christian type version of it, where they have the cross and that's what they use in those forms of exorcisms. But can exorcisms be done in other forms of religion? And essentially,
we've worked with Buddhist monks and everybody else. Yeah.
So do the entities, do they then have to play by the rules of the religion of the living who are being affected by it? Is that what we're...
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. I would never go into a Hindu family and bring a Christian priest.
Sure. Why is that? Why is it that they have to play by the rules of the living?
Because we shape the haunting.
Okay.
We shape the entity. The entity is not shaped by itself. It doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Okay. The term demonologist is thrown out. All the time. I joke quite often where there's going to be similar to like a meal kit delivery service, like demonologist in a box soon, where it's like every month.
Where demonology got its start?
How?
King James.
Okay.
He wrote the first book on demonology.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, same guy that had the Bible.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yep.
I did not know
that. He was totally in fear of witches and demons, and he wrote the very first book. When I was a kid, there were, I believe, 4 or 5 priests who were considered demonologists in the United States, and my grandfather. He was the only layman who was recognized as a demonologist by the church. As I got older, he said I was now a demonologist. I held that title for maybe 2 years, and by the time I was 26, I said, you know, I've learned enough to realize I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't possibly hold on to that title. And anytime I hear somebody say they're a demonologist, I don't say anything, but inside I'm just shaking my head.
Sure. No, I understand. It's thrown around far too often.
Yeah.
When
anybody who says they're an expert on demons is fooling themselves.
Yeah. Well, I always say that about the topic of ghosts or demons. It's because we get thrown that at us quite a bit, where it's like, oh, you're an expert on ghosts or hauntings, and my reaction is no one really is. I think we're all
right.
We're all, you know, some of us are more informed than others just because we're involved in it and hearing about it. So I may have more perspectives and experiences I can share, but I have more questions than I have answers today than ever before.
Me too. And that's a sign of wisdom.
Yeah.
Boy, that came out bad. I'm not touting myself.
I'm smarter than everyone. No, I'm kidding.
When you realize what you don't know,
yeah,
then you're starting to understand.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I before I was 26, I thought, oh yeah, I am an expert. And at some point it dawned on me, you don't know a damn thing. And that's when I stopped doing lectures, stopped doing public appearances, and just basically let my grandparents be the frontmen. Mm-hmm. And I liked it that way. It's only been now that everybody knows that my grandmother's retired and my grandfather, of course, is gone, that I have no choice. I have to be here. Otherwise, the work will die, and I won't let their work die.
Yeah.
It's too important.
It's too important, and they have far too many stories that only you and a few others would really know the inside to inform a new generation and a current generation of what they did and what is out there.
Yeah, and it's important to me with the Warren Legacy Foundation. We have three goals. One of those is to support psychics, because often they are overwhelmed by anxieties, by their own empathic abilities. And we want to either help them to control their abilities, help them to suppress their abilities, or help them develop their abilities, depending on what their goals are. Mm-hmm. The second thing, of course, is to be helping people who actually need help. And then our third goal is to educate the next generation of researchers. We're a worldwide organization, a network of professionals who can respond anywhere. And that's all we want to do, is help people.
That's a good goal to have. And it's very straightforward as to what the goal is.
And we want to, you know, raise the bar. We want it to be professional.
Sure.
You know, we want to eliminate the showboats and the egos that populate this field.
Could use a healthy cleansing of that.
Yeah, it's something I've never been comfortable with. Yeah. Is that huge? You know, my grandfather put me in my place once, because I was feeling like I don't know a darn thing. He said, "No, Chris, you don't know much, but you know so much more than everybody else around you. So keep that in mind. You know, as ignorant as I feel every single day, I know I do know more than most people." Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason I feel comfortable being on your show.
Sure. How is your grandma doing now? I know she's retired, but
yeah, how is she? Very retired. She's 92. She's sure. Frail.
Yeah.
She's about 10 feet away from me at the moment.
Oh.
Well, yeah, but below me.
Okay.
She's a floor down.
Okay.
And she's doing fine. She's just, she spends a lot of time sleeping now.
Sure. Sure. That's understandable. Was it difficult for her to say, okay, I've done my part. I'm going to take some time now for me.
Oh no.
Is it?
No.
No.
She was pretty happy about it.
Good.
Yeah. She liked the attention at the end. Mm-hmm. The movies were wonderful for her.
Sure.
You know, that really pleased her. I know that she would think of Ed a lot and how much he would have loved that.
Sure.
My grandfather loved publicity.
Yeah.
He and I, that was a bone of contention between the two of us. But now, looking back on it, I understand him much better. He had to do it that way because otherwise, how could he possibly help other people if they didn't know who he was?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so back in the day, that was it. That was the way. And yeah, he would have loved these movies.
Now,
I don't know how he would have felt about it, Annabelle, though.
Sure.
Closer.
The publicity is an interesting thing with this because, you know, it's one thing where when I began this program about ghosts, it was because I was just genuinely interested and I always have been. But what it ended up turning into was all these people sharing these stories and this community that was created. And everyone not just saying, you know, we get entertainment value out of it, because people certainly do. There's an interest there, but a community and a sense of normalcy of I'm not alone. Other people have experienced something I have experienced. Mm-hmm. And the only way that could be done is with publicity. And so there is a good way, you know, just like there's good ways to yield anything and there's bad ways to yield anything. And there's plenty of bad ways that the topic of ghosts is yield out there. But that's what I like about this is the fact that I feel like, you know, in a little way, at least we're helping a lot of people feel normal and realize they're not alone. And this stuff does happen and you're not crazy.
You know, and I totally agree with that message. That is one thing that I see again and again and again with the psychic support group, because these are people who have felt, well, freakish forever and felt like, you know, they're crazy and what's wrong with them. And they get in the group and it's like, oh my God, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
Other people understand me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's an incredibly powerful thing. I saw it again and again when I've brought people from one case in contact with another case, you know, after the fact, you know, helping them to deal with the traumas involved. And they talk to one another and they realize that they have so much in common with other people, that they're really not strange, that this can happen to anybody.
That wraps up part two of our interview with Christopher Edward McKinnell. A giant thank you to him for sitting down and talking with us today about the legacy of Ed and Lorraine Warren and his paranormal investigative work. Be sure to have him on the program again very soon. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening, and thanks for being a gravekeeper.